Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in 2 Kings chapter 5. In this chapter, we will see Naaman, the Syrian general, healed of leprosy by Elisha. Our context is this. In the last part of chapter 4, in our last audio, we saw Elijah raising the Shunammite woman's son from the dead and other miracles that Elisha did. So starting now in 2 Kings 5, 1 through 6, we read this. Now Naaman, captain of the army of the king of Aram, was a great man with his master and highly respected, because by him the Lord had given victory to Aram. The man was also a valiant warrior, but he was a leper. Now the Arameans had gone out in bands and had taken a captive, and had taken captive a little girl from the land of Israel, and she waited on Naaman's wife. She said to her mistress, "I wish that my master were with the prophet who is in Samaria. Then he would cure him of his leprosy." Naaman went in and told his master, saying, "Thus and thus spoke the girl who is from the land of Israel." Then the king of Aram said, "Go now, and I will send a letter to the king of Israel." He departed and took with him 10 talents of silver and 6,000 shekels of gold in 10 changes of clothes. He brought the letter to the king of Israel, saying, "And now, as this letter comes to you, behold, I have sent Naaman my servant to you, that you may cure him of his leprosy." Now this king of Aram that is being talked about in these first 6 verses is very most probably Ben-Hadad II, who ruled between 860 and 841 B.C. The pulpit commentator names him. A lot of the other commentators just call him the king of Aram because they're not sure, but I feel pretty sure that's who it is. Now, Elisha prophesied in the time of King Joram of northern Israel, and Joram ruled from 852 to 841 B.C., so that means he died in the same year that Ben-Hadad II died, so they're very roughly contemporaneous. Now, Ben-Hadad II ruled 8 years earlier than Joram did, so he was contemporaneous with Ahaziah, 853 to 852, and also Ahab, who ruled 874 to 853. So from 860 to 853, Ben-Hadad II and Ahab were operating opposite of each other. And Ben-Hadad II, in fact, had fought 3 wars with Ahab during that time. We have Ahab defeating Ben-Hadad II in the siege of Samaria, 1 Kings 21 through 4. Now Ben-Hadad II, king of Aram, gathered all his army, and there were 32 kings with him, horses and chariots. He went up and besieged Samaria. And then says Ben-Hadad, "Your silver and your gold are mine. Your most beautiful wives and children are also mine." But he didn't take them because Ahab beat him. And then the winter passes, and the next spring, Ahab went out and fought Ben-Hadad II at Aphek, 1 Kings 20, 29 through 30. They camped opposite each other for 7 days. That's Ahab and Ben-Hadad II camped opposite each other. On the 7th day, the battle took place, and the Israelites struck down the Arameans, 100,000 foot soldiers in 1 day. And of course, the Arameans are the Syrians to the northeast of Israel. Verse 30, 1 Kings 20, "The ones who remained fled into the city of Aphek, and the wall fell on those 27,000 remaining men. Ben-Hadad II also fled and went into an inner room in the city." We've already talked about that in 1 Kings chapter 20. So those are 2 big battles. Ahab won them both, but then Ben-Hadad II fought Ahab at the Battle of Ramoth-Gilead, and Ben-Hadad II's army killed Ahab because a stray arrow hit Ahab in the joints of his armor. 1 Kings 22, 34 through 35, "But a man drew his bow without taking special aim and struck the king of Israel through the joints of his armor. So Ahab said to his charioteer, 'Turn around and take me out of the battle, for I am badly wounded.' The battle raged throughout that day, and the king was propped up in his chariot facing the Arameans. He died that evening, and blood from his wound flowed into the bottom of the chariot." You recall that story in 1 Kings 22. So, 3 battles, and Ahab won 2 of them. But it's interesting that in verse 1, Naaman is said to be highly respected because by him the Lord had given victory to Aram. I just assume that's at the Battle of Ramoth-Gilead where Ahab was killed. The other 2 battles are not mentioned. And by the way, that battle at Ramoth-Gilead was really sort of a draw because the Israelites didn't take the town. When Ahab got killed, they just scattered and came back home. They weren't routed or chased or anything. It was more like a draw, except that Ahab got killed, so I guess that's victory enough. So Ramoth-Gilead seems to be the only battle won by Naaman, but he had high honor. Now notice how the author of our text, which we think is probably Jeremiah, gave honor to Yahweh. The Lord had given victory to Aram. God is even given credit for victory over Israel. Israel's not mentioned here. He'd given victory to Aram, but it's understood, and that just shows that the Israelites knew that Yahweh was in control of all events, including negative ones. Even though it was a pagan country defeating Israel, the author of 2 Kings gave credit to Yahweh for defeating Israel. There's a constant awareness in the scriptures that God is in control of all history. Now, it could be that the reference here to where the Lord had given victory to Aram was when Micaiah the prophet, prophesying in the name of the Lord, in the name of Yahweh, had told Ahab and his ally, the southern king Jehoshaphat, you're going to lose. And so then that's how the Lord gave victory to Ahab. Now, this little Israelite girl who was waiting, serving Naaman's wife, was taken in slavery by a raiding party. These plunderers either sold this little girl to Naaman or gave the little girl to Naaman, trying to suck up to him. She's obviously heard of Elisha before she was taken into slavery. She tells her mistress that she wishes that Naaman, her master, could get together with Elisha, who is in Samaria. Now, that Samaria is either the city or the northern kingdom, because sometimes the northern kingdom was named Samaria by convention. But wherever he was, Elisha moved all over the place. He was in Samaria somewhere. He was in the northern kingdom, and the little girl said, oh, I wish he could come cure Naaman. That's pretty nice of her, considering she was a slave. Now, this little girl knew that prophets not only prophesied, taught, and encouraged other prophets, they healed people. This Elisha had the power of God working with him. So Naaman goes and talks to Ben-Hadad II, his master, in verse 4. Obviously, he heard what the little girl had said through his wife. So he goes to Ben-Hadad II and says, help me out here. And so Ben-Hadad II says, okay, I'll send a letter to Ahab. So he did. And this is what the letter said. Quote, and now as this letter comes to you, Ahab, behold, I have sent Naaman my servant to you, that you may cure him of his leprosy. You, Ahab, cure somebody that has leprosy? Well, what does that mean? Naaman obviously didn't expect King Joram, who of course is king now, Ahab having been killed, Nahab didn't expect Joram to cure Naaman of leprosy. What he meant was for Joram to recommend Naaman to Elisha so they could meet up. I wonder why Naaman didn't make himself clearer. I don't know, but as we'll see in the following verses, Ahab mistook Naaman's meaning. He thought that Naaman was trying to set him up. Naaman and Ben-Hadad II were trying to set Joram up for trouble. We'll talk about that in just a minute. Let's now look at the money or the wealth that Naaman took with him to Israel. 10 talents of silver, that's 750 pounds. 750 pounds of silver, that's quite a lot. 6,000 shekels of gold, that's 150 pounds of gold. This is from the Holman Christian Study Bible. That is a lot of wealth, and it's heavy. He also took clothes, too, and of course, back then, clothes, fine garments were a store of wealth. Now, of course, Naaman's going to use this to pay the prophet, but he was also going to use the silver and gold to defray the cost of the trip, I'm sure. But at any rate, this shows how valuable one's health is. He's willing to spend all that money to get rid of that leprosy, and that makes sense. What is that famous verse in Job, I think it is, pound for pound a man would give for his skin? I forgot the verse, but when you're sick, you'll give anything to get well, because there's nothing worse than being sick. Nothing. Worse. Well, there's something worse, I guess, but not much is worse than being sick. We go down to 2 Kings chapter 5, verses 7 through 10. When the king of Israel read the letter, he tore his clothes and said, am I God to kill and to make alive, that this man is sending word to me to cure a man of his leprosy? But consider now and see how he is seeking a quarrel against me. It happened when Elisha, the man of God, heard that the king of Israel had torn his clothes, that Elisha sent word to the king, saying, why have you torn your clothes? Now let him come to me. Let Naaman come to me, and Naaman shall know that there's a prophet in Israel. So Naaman came with his horses and his chariots and stood at the doorway of the house of Elisha. Elisha sent a messenger to him, saying, go and wash in the Jordan 7 times, and your flesh will be restored to you, and you will be clean. Now why was Joram so upset when he got this message from Naaman, or actually from Ben-Hadad II, in behalf of Naaman? Well, I'm going to give you a silly possible reason, option, somebody has said somewhere that Joram was upset because Naaman had blasphemed, because he had asked Joram to do what only God could do. No. Do we really think that Naaman is so spiritual that he cares about blasphemy? Do we even think that Joram is so spiritual that he cares about blasphemy? No. What Joram was thinking is that Naaman was setting him up, setting Joram up for a fight. Naaman asked for something that's impossible, so Joram has no choice but to refuse the impossible request. Therefore, Naaman gets angry because the request is refused, and now he's got a good excuse to go attack Israel. That's what Joram is thinking. But Elisha is not intimidated by this impossible request because he has the power of God with him. He says, send him on, bring him on. He'll know there's a prophet in Israel once I pray to Yahweh and Yahweh heals him. So Naaman came to see Elisha. He came with his horses and his chariots. That's a splendid retinue. Why did he bring such a rich procession of horses? Well, he was used to traveling in style to honor himself. Now, note how incongruous this was. He's a leper sitting in state behind a bunch of horses and chariots. Well, he might have been traveling that way to honor himself, but he also might have been trying to give honor to Elijah the prophet because he wants Elijah to think highly of him so that Elijah will use his healing power on Naaman. So he goes to Elijah's house in verse 9. Now, Elijah is probably living at Gilgal now. There's about four Gilgals on my map. This is the one between Shechem in the north and Bethel in the south on Mount Ephraim and in the hills of Ephraim, there in that spine that runs north and south from northern Israel all the way down to Jerusalem and below. So this is probably the Gilgal where he was. Remember, that's the same Gilgal where the school of the prophets was, one of the schools of the prophets, and Elisha's on his circuit, and he goes down there, and they're hungry. There's a famine. They pick some wild gourds, one of the prophets does, puts the wild gourds in the pot, and it was poisonous. There was death in the pot. Well, that was at Gilgal. So that's probably where he was now. And so here comes Naaman with his horses and his chariots. Now remember, Elisha's a prophet. He probably has a very poor house, probably a hut. So here you have this guy, this Syrian general showing up with a bunch of chariots and horses parked in front of a little hovel. Nonetheless, Elisha didn't bother to get out of his little hovel to meet Naaman. He sent a messenger out to him. I suspect that was Gehazi, his personal servant. Now, I have found five different possible reasons why Elisha did not appear personally to Naaman. I'm going to go through them. I don't know what the answer is. I'll report. You decide. Here's option number one. Elisha wanted to stay private so he could pray for Naaman's cure. I don't think that's reasonable. He could pray for Naaman's cure with Naaman present. I don't see why that's an answer. Option number two is why Elisha didn't appear personally to Naaman is because Elisha wanted to show contempt for Naaman's worldly grandeur and honor. He wanted to mortify Naaman's pride. This is Colin Delitzsch in the pulpit commentary. Say that. That sounds pretty reasonable to me. These prophets can be sort of cantankerous. Option number three is to why Elisha did not appear personally to Naaman. Elisha did not want to become unclean by touching a leper. Now, the Cambridge commentary and Colin Dillich mentions that as an option, but they deny it. But Ellicott affirms that reason. Elisha just didn't want to be around a leper. He would become unclean. He'd have to go through the purification ritual, assuming he could still follow the law. Option number four is why Elisha didn't appear personally to Naaman. Elisha did not want Naaman to credit Elisha with working the miracle. Cambridge commentary and the commentator Poole affirm that idea. Elisha's just trying to be modest, because if he had gone out there and prayed for Naaman to get healed, and Naaman's healed, well, then Naaman's going to say, oh, Elisha, you're a man of God, may I bow down to you and worship you, and so forth, and Elisha didn't want that. That's actually fairly reasonable to me. Option number five is to why Elisha didn't appear personally to Naaman. He wanted to exercise Naaman's faith. He wanted to see, are you going to really believe in Yahweh if I'm not present? That's Matthew Poole's idea. And of course, it could be any number of these five options in conjunction with each other. Whatever the reason was that Elisha had for not coming out, Naaman took his non-appearance as rudeness and rode off angry. Well, what was he angry about? The messenger came to him and said, go wash in the Jordan seven times. That's all he had to do. Go dip himself in the Jordan River seven times. But he No, he's not going to do that. He just rides off angry, probably because Elijah didn't show him enough honor by coming out to meet him. Now, why did Elisha ask Naaman through the messenger to dip himself 7 times in the Jordan River? John Gill says, quote, according to the law of the cleansing of the leper, he was to be sprinkled 7 times, and on the 7th day, his flesh was to be bathed or dipped all over in water, which is meant by washing here. So the law says you sprinkle the leper 7 times, and you dip him in water 7 times. So this is similar to that. And of course, Elijah's going to be familiar with the law, school of the prophets guy. You know, they taught as well as prophesied. They kept the meaning of the law alive there in pagan golden calf northern Israel. And so that's probably why he did it. Here's the law in Leviticus 14:7. He, the priest, shall sprinkle 7 times the one who's to be cleansed from leprosy and pronounce him clean. And then Leviticus 14:9, it shall be on the 7th day that he shall shave off all his hair. He shall shave his head and his beard and his eyebrows, even all his hair. He shall then wash his clothes and bathe his body in water and be clean. So you see, this dipping in the Jordan is somewhat analogous to the Levitical ritual. And besides, the number 7 is a well-known symbol of completeness and perfection in the Old Testament, and when a leper is healed, he has been made completely whole. So now we go to 2 Kings 5, verses 11 through 14. But Naaman was furious, and he went away and said, behold, I thought he will surely come out to me and stand and call on the name of the Lord his God and wave his hand over the place and cure the leper. Are not Arbana and Pharpar, the rivers of Damascus, better than all the waters of Israel? Could I not wash in them and be clean? It's a little haughty. So he turned and went away in a rage. Then his servants came near and spoke to him and said, my father, had the prophet told you to do some great thing, would you not have done it? How much more then when he says to you, wash and be clean? How much more then when he says to you, wash and be clean? So Naaman went down and dipped himself 7 times in the Jordan, according to the word of the man of God, Elisha. And Naaman's flesh was restored like the flesh of a little child, and he was clean. Well, Naaman's furious in verse 11 because Elisha didn't come out and bow and scrape to him. Perhaps the leprosy hadn't taken the edge off his pride quite yet. Adam Clark says this, quote, instead of humbling himself before the Lord's prophet, he expected the prophet of the Lord to humble himself before him. Pride, the deadly sin of pride, could have cost him a healing. His pride could have condemned him to a lifelong bout with leprosy. Now notice that Naaman says that Elisha could have come out and called on the name of the Lord his God, the name of Yahweh his God. He uses the right name for the Lord, Yahweh, but then he says Yahweh is Elisha's God. Not his, not Naaman's, but Elisha's. Naaman is not a believer in Yahweh quite yet because the leprosy is not going away. Now, Naaman expects Elisha to wave his hand over the place, wave his hand around. Now, what does that mean? Here's what Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say, quote, it was anciently, and still continues to be, a very prevalent superstition in the East that the hand of a king or a person of great reputed sanctity touching or waved over a sore will heal it. That's the ancient East in medieval history. Every king, having been anointed with a holy oil, was assumed to have the power of the touch, the king's touch, they called it, the power to heal scrofula, one type of disease. I don't know what scrofula was. And the poor people, the people with skin disease, would come up to the king, and the king would lay his hand on them. He was sort of a quasi-religious figure. So that's the idea of waving your hand around to heal somebody has been around a long time, not just in the ancient Near East. In verse 12, Naaman says, are not my two rivers in Damascus, Abana and Pharpar, better than this Jordan River here? That's a little ethnocentric. Abana means stony. This is from Easton's dictionary. It's the chief river of Damascus. It's called in Greek the Golden Stream. It rises in a cleft of the Anti-Lebanon Range, about 23 miles northwest of Damascus, and after flowing southward for a little way, parts into 3 smaller streams, the central one flowing through Damascus, and the other 2 on each side of the city, diffusing beauty and fertility where otherwise there would be barrenness. There'd be a desert except for the river there, the Abana River, so that's a big river if you're from Damascus. Pharpar was... It means swift. It was one of the other rivers of Damascus. So after bragging about his rivers, running down the Jordan River, running down Elisha, his servants came to him and said, my father, what's the big deal here? It's not a hard thing to go dip yourself in the Jordan. What have you got to lose? That's basically what they're saying here. They were gutsy enough to rebuke the big-shot Syrian general. Now, they rebuked him in an ever-so-gentle fashion. They called him my father, which is a title of highest respect and affection. And basically, they're saying, what have you got to lose, Naaman? It's an easy thing. Go dip yourself in the Jordan. Maybe you'll be lucky. Maybe you'll get clean. This guy Elisha's got a big reputation for healing people. Maybe you better go do it. And Naaman, once his pride and his passion had subsided, he probably thought, that's reasonable. I better go do it. Now, he might not have expected success. Adam Clark says he probably expected little success, but it was so easy to try it. Why not go do it? So I don't know whether he expected to get healed or not, but he did it. We go to 2 Kings 5, verses 15 through 16. When he returned to the man of God, that's Naaman, when Naaman returned to Elisha with all his company, with all Naaman's company, and came and stood before Elisha, he said, behold now, I know that there is no God in all the earth but in Israel, so please take a present from your servant now. Well, I forgot to mention verse 14. I think that Naaman actually took the advice of Elisha, went down and dipped himself 7 times in the Jordan, and his flesh was restored like the skin of a little child. And so now in verse 15, Naaman, after having been healed of the Jordan, goes back to Samaria, or wherever, say it's Gilgal, where Elisha was, and said, behold now, Elisha, I know that there's no God in all the earth but in Israel, so please take a present from your servant now. But Elisha said, as the Lord lives, before whom I stand, I will take nothing. And Naaman urged Elisha to take it, but Elisha refused. Elisha is swearing an oath, as the Lord lives. If you do a search on as the Lord lives, it'll probably show up about 2 or 3 million times in the Old Testament. That was a standard way of swearing by Yahweh. This is a nice thing to contemplate if you are an Amish-type person who thinks that taking an oath is sinful. If it is, there were a lot of sinful people in the Old Testament. Now, why did Naaman go back to Elisha's house after having been healed in the Jordan River? Well, he wanted to go back and thank him. Elisha refused to take anything. Why? Well, so that the cure would be attributed to God, not to Elisha, to show that Elisha's motives were not monetary. Oh, this is a good passage for Joel Osteen and Mr. Cashflow Dollar. Elisha's motives were the glory of God, not to get rich. Now, Elisha did take presents on other occasions. 2 Kings 4:42, this is the death in the pot story. We read this, now a man came from Baal Shalishah and brought the man of God, brought Elisha, bread of the first fruits, 20 loaves of barley and fresh ears of grain in his sack. The Holman Christian Study Bible just says 20 loaves of barley. And he said, give them to the people that they may eat. Well, yeah, Elisha took a present that time. It wasn't 150 pounds of gold and 750 pounds of silver. It was 20 barley loaves, which is almost nothing. And plus, he didn't even keep the present for himself. He gave it to the prophets that they might eat. So, big difference. Naaman is especially rich. And so Elisha's being very careful here to show that he's not pandering to money. Adam Clark says, quote, it was very common to give presents to all great and official men, and among these, prophets were always included. So this was kind of giving presents in the East. Oh my gosh, they still do that in China. I never saw so many presents being passed. Wore me out watching people give presents to other people. So this is a cultural thing. You got to give a present to the prophet. But it was such a huge present. So much money involved. Elisha, at the risk of being taken as a rude man, refused to take the gift. He did not want to have Yahweh's motives or his motives impugned. We go now to 2 Kings 5, 17 through 19. Naaman said, if not, if you're not going to take my present, please let your servant at least be given 2 mules load of earth. Please let me, Naaman, at least be given 2 mules load of earth, for your servant, me, Naaman, will no longer offer burnt offering, nor will he sacrifice to other gods, but to the Lord, but to Yahweh. In this matter, may Yahweh pardon your servant when my master goes into the house of Rimmon to worship there, and he leans on my hand, and my master, that's Ben-Hadad II, leans on my hand, and I bow myself in the house of Rimmon. When I bow myself in the house of Rimmon, the Lord pardon your servant in this matter. Elisha said to Naaman, go in peace. So Naaman departed from Elisha some distance. There's 2 possible reasons as to why Naaman wanted to carry 2 mules load of earth back to Syria. Option number 1, Naaman wanted to build an altar in Aram. Problem with that is what sort of a tiny altar could be built with just 2 mule loads of earth? Well, you could say Naaman wanted superstitiously to gather earth from Elisha's house, and then he could mix that earth from Elisha's house in with other common dirt in Aram, kind of a superstitious type thing. But most people don't believe that that's why he wanted the 2 mule loads of earth. Pulpit commentary says the real reason is Naaman wanted to hallow a piece of Syrian land by spreading earth over it. Hallow means to make holy. Naaman wanted to holify a piece of land in Aram so he could offer sacrifices there or whatever he would do there to worship Yahweh. The pulpit commentator says this is the more general opinion of those two opinions, so as not to build an altar, but it's to spread earth all over the ground to make the ground holy. Now, there's some problems with this, and these problems apply to option number A, too, that the earth was going to be used for an altar. Couldn't he just take the earth from anywhere in Israel without Elisha's permission? Why did he need to ask Elisha if he could take 2 mule loads of earth? My answer to that is Naaman was just being polite. Another problem is, well, if permission is indeed needed, wouldn't it be the king who would give the permission and not Elisha? Again, Naaman's just being polite. Why do you need to ask permission to take some dirt from a country? Who's going to even care? So I think the answer to this is that Naaman is going to take some dirt from the Holy Land and make a patch of ground in Syria a part of the Holy Land. Now we come to an interesting problem. Naaman asks Elisha, after telling Elisha that he is only going to worship Yahweh, he will not sacrifice to any other god, he will not offer any burnt offering to any other god but to Yahweh. And then he says, but I got one little problem here. When I go back, my master Ben-Hadad II, he's an idolater. He's going to want to go into the house of Rimmon, our Syrian god, and he wants to lean on my hand and bow with me. Now, there are 2 reasons possibly why Ben-Hadad II would want Naaman to lean on Ben-Hadad II's hand. One option is that Ben-Hadad II is old and infirm, and so he needs help. Another option is this is some kind of ritual that the chief general would have to bow down with the king. It's not really clear what it is, but the point is that Naaman would be required, because of his official duties, to bow down in a pagan temple to a pagan god, Rimmon. Now, here's a big question that commentators have written a lot on, and I'm going to read you a lot from the commentators. This is sort of an interesting question. Was Naaman asking for advance permission to sin? He says, I'll worship Yahweh, but just give me one exception here. I'm going to have to sin by bowing down to Rimmon, so how about let me get by with that? Is that what he was doing? Well, we're going to look at 2 options here. The first option is no, that's not what he was doing. Naaman has completely renounced idolatry, and he is not intending to go back to it when he goes back to Syria. And option number 2 is, yes, Naaman is asking in advance for permission to sin. He wants an exception to his Yahweh worship. So let's see how the commentators divide on this issue, and they do divide. First option, Naaman has completely renounced his idolatry. Well, how do we show that? Well, here's one way is to translate the verbs concerning Rimmon, worshiping Rimmon. All those verbs should be translated in the past tense. This is Gill and Poole's suggestion. So we would read the verse this way. When my master went into the house of Rimmon to worship there, and he leaned on my hand, and I bowed myself in the house of Rimmon. When I bowed myself in the house of Rimmon, may the Lord pardon your servant in this matter. And, of course, that would make perfectly good sense if the verses can be translated in the past tense. I don't know a word of Hebrew except shalom, so I don't know whether that's right or not. But let me read you what Gill says. Quote, well, he basically translates the verse like I just did. Let me read you what Poole said. Quote, it is useless to enter into the controversy concerning this verse. By no rule of right reasoning, nor by any legitimate mode of interpretation, can it be stated that Naaman is asking pardon for offenses which he may commit, or that he could ask or the prophet grant indulgence to bow himself in the temple of Rimmon, thus performing a decided act of homage, the very essence of that worship which immediately before he solemnly assured the prophet he would never practice. The original may legitimately be read and ought to be read in the past and not in the future tense. And then, I'm sorry, I said Poole, this is Clark saying this, Adam Clark. And so then Adam Clark goes on to translate, "For this thing the Lord pardon thy servant, for that when my master hath gone into the house of Rimmon to worship there, he hath leaned upon mine hand, that I also have bowed myself in the house of Rimmon. For my worshiping in the house of Rimmon, the Lord pardon thy servant in this thing." Now, Clark goes on to say, this is the translation of Dr. Lightfoot. Now, that Dr. Lightfoot is no slouch. He, of course, is one of the divines at the Westminster Assembly, 1648. Clark says, this is the translation of Dr. Lightfoot, the most able Hebraist of his time in Christendom. To admit the common interpretation is to admit, in effect, the doctrine of indulgences. In other words, Naaman would be saying, give me an indulgence so that I can bow down in a pagan temple. It's, in effect, Clark continues, the doctrine of indulgences, and that we may do evil, the good may come of it, that the end sanctifies the means, and that for political purposes we may do unlawful acts, which of course sounds terrible. This is a very good argument here, that Naaman has completely renounced his idolatry. But not everybody's buying it. Some commentators say that Naaman actually is indeed asking in advance for permission to sin. Here's the pulpit commentary, quote, "Naaman is not prepared to be a martyr for his religion. On returning to Damascus, it will be among his civil duties to accompany his master to the national temples and to prostrate himself before the images of the national deities. If he declines, if, like an early Christian, he will not enter the house of devils, much less bow down before the graven image of a false god, it may cost him his life. It will certainly cost him his court favor. For such a sacrifice he is not prepared. Yet his conscience tells him that he will be acting wrongly. He therefore expresses a hope or a prayer that his fault, for a fault he feels that it will be, may be forgiven him, that Yahweh will not be extreme to mark what is done amiss, but will excuse his outward conformity to his inward faith and zeal." So the pulpit commentator gives him a pass for doing that. Kyle and Illich do too. They say this, quote, "And because Naaman's knowledge of God was still adulterated with superstition, he was not yet prepared to make an unreserved confession before men of his faith in Jehovah as the only true God, in Yahweh as the only true God, but hoped that Yahweh would forgive him if he still continued to join outwardly in the worship of idols, so far as his official duty required." Here's what Ellicott says, quote, "Naaman had solemnly promised to serve no God but Jehovah, but Yahweh for the future. He now prays that an unavoidable exception, which will indeed be such only in appearance, may be excused by Yahweh. His request is not, of course, to be judged by a Christian standard." A Christian standard? Cambridge says this, "We must judge both Naaman and the prophet according to the times in which they lived. It was impossible for the former at once to cast away all his old ideas." I got a problem here. Not bowing down to idols? Is that not also an Old Testament standard? Why do we all of a sudden start bringing in Christian standards here to let Naaman off the hook? I think that is an extraordinarily weak argument. Well, let's go back to option number one, that Naaman has completely renounced idolatry. We said we could support that idea by translating all the verbs in the past tense. Well, here's another way you can do it. This is the commentator Poole. He says that Naaman is only formally bowing to Rimmon, the pagan idol. He's only formally doing it to help the king out in the king's infirmity, but he doesn't really mean it in his heart. Poole says this is only the appearance of evil, not evil itself. Well, I don't think that's a good argument. You bow down in a temple? I was actually asked to bow down in a Buddhist temple with an incense stick. And, of course, I could say, well, I'm just doing this to make my host, just to be polite. I said, I'm sorry. I can't do it. I don't care whether you think I'm rude or not. Fortunately, the man was very gracious, not a problem. But I don't think Naaman is going to get away with apparently or superficially or externally bowing down to an idol and then being able to tell God, well, I didn't really mean it. Because everybody sees it. It sets a terrible example. But the past tense idea, I think, will make Naaman be completely free of idolatry. Whether that's true or not, I am not dead sure. The commentators are split. Once again, I will report and you decide. Verse 19, Elijah responds to this request in somewhat of an ambiguous way when Naaman asked that he be pardoned for bowing down to Rimmon. Verse 19, Elisha said to Naaman, go in peace. Go in peace. What is he saying there? Well, some people saying he agreed to Naaman's request. And so, therefore, Elisha would be condoning bowing down to an idol in an idol temple. Well, that depends. That depends on whether the request was in the future tense or the past tense. That depends. But you can interpret that go in peace in another way, saying that Elisha is being noncommittal. He's just, go in peace just means goodbye, so long, sayonara, see you later. It's just a polite way of saying goodbye. It's not meant to agree with Naaman and his request. Jameson Fawcett and Brown says this, quote, Elisha's prophetic commission not extending to any but the conversion of Israel from idolatry, he makes no remark, either approving or disapproving, on the declared course of Naaman, but simply gives the parting benediction. So there's a lot of ambiguity here, a lot of ways you can take this, but however we take it, we need to keep our eyes on the main point here, is that God has worked a miracle and showed that miracle to a pagan in a foreign country and converted someone to Yahweh with a healing. By the way, is that not what happened in the New Testament when Jesus healed all those people and the apostles healed all those people? Healing is a great evangelistic tool. Are you listening, Justin Peters? Are you listening, John MacArthur? We go down to 2 Kings 5:20-22. But Gehazi, the servant of Elisha, the man of God, thought, Behold, my master has spared this Naaman the Aramean by not receiving from his hands what he brought. As the Lord lives, I will run after him and take something from him. So Gehazi pursued Naaman. When Naaman saw one running after him, he came down from the chariot to meet him and said, Is all well? Gehazi said, All is well. My master Elisha has sent me, saying, Behold, just now two young men of the sons of the prophets have come to me from the hill country of Ephraim. Please give them a talent of silver and two changes of clothes. Now Gehazi is going to be condemned here. Well, he's going to get leprosy for what he's doing here. And that could be because he is a totally selfish human being. Or it could be he was thinking of the prophets because they're poor, and he thought maybe I can get some money for them. So he might not have been totally selfish, but he was still an idiot and a liar. Now notice when Gehazi has run after Naaman and caught up with him, that Naaman actually stops and comes down from his chariot. The big, proud Naaman, he's not so proud anymore. He's showing honor to a servant coming down from the chariot. His attitude has changed much since his dealings with Elisha and since his miraculous healing. And of course, seeing Gehazi running after the chariot, after Naaman's chariot, would make Naaman think there was something wrong. Maybe Elisha had fallen ill, as Gil suggests. Gehazi said, Look, two sons of the prophets have come up from the hill country of Ephraim. That's probably Gilgal, where the sons of the prophets were. Wherever, doesn't matter. They came and they're poor, is what the implication is. They're prophets. They need money. So Gehazi makes a bald-faced solicitation for money. Please give them a talent of silver. That's 75 pounds, folks. Please give these two prophets 75 pounds of silver and two changes of clothes, and those were nice clothes, noble's clothes, very, very valuable. 75 pounds of silver he's asking for. This guy sounds like Creflo Cashflow Dollar. This guy sounds like Joel Osteen. This guy sounds like David Duplessis. We go down to verses 23-26. But Naaman insisted, Please accept 150 pounds. In other words, instead of 75 pounds, I'm going to give you 150 pounds. He's in a giving, generous mood, having just had a miracle done with him. He urged Gehazi and then packed 150 pounds of silver in two bags with two changes of clothes. He didn't up the contribution on the clothes from what was requested. He gave two changes of clothes, one for each of these two fake prophets that Gehazi lied about. 75 pounds of silver for one prophet and 75 pounds of silver in another bag for the other prophet. Two servants were necessary to carry all of this because 75 pounds is somewhat heavy. One person couldn't carry 150 pounds. So two of his servants went ahead of Gehazi carrying the silver. When Gehazi came to the hill, that's probably Samaria because Samaria was on a hill, he took the gifts from them. He took the gifts from the two servants of Naaman. And then Gehazi stored the money in the house. That would be Elisha's house. Now remember, Gehazi's been with Elisha a long time. Gehazi was with Elisha when Elisha healed the son of the Shunammite woman who had the heat stroke. Gehazi was the one that laid the staff of Elisha on the boy's head trying to get him healed. He's obviously, Elisha must have thought well of Gehazi because Elisha's had him for quite a while. He's been his servant. So this is sort of a surprising thing that Gehazi would do. So he stored the money away where Elisha can't see it. Gehazi dismisses the two men of Naaman. The two men of Naaman leave in verse 24. Verse 25, Gehazi came and stood by his master. And now the fun begins. Where did you go, Gehazi? Elisha asked him. Here's the response. Your servant didn't go anywhere. That is a bald-faced lie. You're lying to a prophet of God. That's pretty cheeky. His lust for money obviously blinded his reason. Man, the love of money is the root of all evil. The evil is coming here as leprosy on Gehazi. So Elisha, when he was lied to, when Gehazi says, I didn't go anywhere, Elisha says, wasn't my spirit there when the man got down from his chariot, when Naaman got down from his chariot to meet you? What Elisha is saying when he says, is my spirit there? He's saying, I'm a prophet. The Lord revealed to my spirit what was going on. So that's just another way of saying my spirit was there. I knew what was going on. So in other words, you're lying. I caught you. And then Elisha says, is it a time to accept money and clothes, olive orchards and vineyards, sheep and oxen, and male and female slaves? Now, of course, all of that was not offered by Naaman to Gehazi, but 150 pounds of silver could have bought all that, olive orchards and vineyards, sheep and oxen, male and female slaves. And so then Elisha says, is this a good time to do that? Well, no time will be a good time to do it, but especially now it's a bad time. Why? Well, by Gehazi taking the money, he had impugned Elisha's honor. Elisha had just made a big deal about not taking money. He says, no, I'm not going to take the money, Naaman, when Naaman offered it to him. And here his servant is going around asking for money, making Elisha look like a total hypocrite. Gehazi had also impugned God's honor. It made it look like Elisha was in it for the money. It made it look like God's servants were in it for the money, both Elisha and Gehazi. Gehazi's request for money also endangered Naaman's newfound faith. How's it going to look to Naaman when he finds out he was robbed by a lie? Actually, I don't know what Naaman, if Naaman ever found out. I hope he didn't. That's an interesting question. Whatever happened to that money? It's a very interesting question. I don't think we know. Maybe it's in the next chapter that I haven't read yet, but I don't think we know what happened to that money. And so now here comes the payoff. 2 Kings 5, verse 27. Elisha continues speaking to Gehazi. Therefore, the leprosy of Naaman shall cling to you and to your descendants forever. So he went out from his presence. Gehazi went out from Elisha's presence, a leper as white as snow. The love of money is the root of all evil. Now, the descendants of Gehazi are going to have leprosy too. That makes it sound like this skin disease here is passed on to children. By the way, this is not the same leprosy that we have today. Today's leprosy is Hansen's disease. The New American Standard Bible translates the skin disease as leprosy. The Holman Christian Study Bible just translates it as skin disease. So we don't know what disease it was. I don't think naturally leprosy would pass on to children. I don't think it's hereditable. Adam Clark says it was, but again, how does Adam Clark know anything about what kind of disease it was back then? So it could be. It's just that God is going to cause the descendants of Naaman to have leprosy just by putting it on them, supernaturally, not naturally. John Gill says that the leprosy that Naaman had is described, because it is described as being as white as snow, that shows that this is the worst form of leprosy, incurable. I don't know enough about that disease to know, and I don't know how Gill knows either, back in the 1800s or 1700s. At any rate, Naaman sure paid for his greed. The application of all this, oh my goodness, wouldn't you love to have Joel Osteen in your audience or Cashflow Dollar talking about the love of money? Kenneth Copeland. Ladies and gentlemen, we are now finished with 2 Kings 5:27. We are now ready to go to 2 Kings chapter 6. The entire chapter, we will look at two things. First, the famous floating axe head of Elisha, and we will also see Ben-Hadad II again besieging Samaria. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.